It's a special two-hour edition of Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Two candidate debates are on this week's agenda. Both were hosted by UW-La Crosse. In our second hour, we'll hear from candidates in Wisconsin's 32nd State Senate District, incumbent Jennifer Schilling and challenger Bill Feehan. But in this hour, we'll hear what was the only debate this fall featuring the candidates in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. Democratic Congressman Ron Kind of La Crosse has held the job since 1996. His Republican challenger is Colonel Ray Boland of Sparta, a 30-year Army veteran, former commander at Fort McCoy, and the former secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Veterans Affairs. Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District stretches across many of the state's southwest and west central counties, and since last year's redistricting took effect, an area that angles into the central part of the state. Among the cities included in the new 3rd District are La Crosse, Prairie du Chien, Mauston, Eau Claire, and Stevens Point. In this debate, which took place at UW-La Crosse on Tuesday, the candidates were each allowed an opening statement and then given about a minute and a half each to respond to questions from a media panel and the audience. The moderator is UW-La Crosse political science professor Joe Heim.
The candidates for the 3rd Congressional District are probably no strangers to any of you. On my right and your left, I always think politics is fun with that stuff, is incumbent Congressman Ron Kind. His challenger on my left is Ray Boland. Now, we flipped a coin, and Colonel Boland is going to go first, so we'll start right away. Colonel Boland.
Thank you, Joe. I'd like to begin by just expressing a brief moment of a thought and prayer about the victims of the terrible storm that's going on. We all hope that there are no more fatalities, and earlier today I was at a event here in La Crosse where people are donating food. That kind of thing's going on all over the country, and that, of course, is our way. I would like to express my thanks, too, to the sponsors for making this event possible tonight and for being here to participate. Exactly 1 week, we will all get to exercise one of our most fundamental and important rights, and that is to vote. There are many that say this is the most important election ever. I've heard that before in my lifetime, and I won't rank this one, but certainly it is of great importance to all of us. We've got important decisions to make, to decide about the future of our country and who we want to lead us in the White House. And here in the 3rd District, we have a decision to make as to which of the two candidates you think can best represent us in the future. And in this district, I think you have two very distinct choices. My opponent, of course, has been in Congress for 16 years, and I spent 30 years in the United States Army and 12 years in state government, so our experiences differ quite a bit. And then I think our records of accomplishment are different. Our positions on the issues are very different. The congressman has pretty much supported the policies of the current administration for the past 4 years. He has supported our added spending and borrowing. He is a strong supporter of Obamacare. He has resisted reforms of programs that I think are badly in need of reform. I happen to like the ideas that Paul Ryan has put on the table. In fact, these are ideas I've been talking to Paul about for quite a while. And the congressman, of course, has been critical of those concepts. And so I'm hopeful that this evening, as we work through these issues, we'll get a chance to talk about those in more detail. When we talk about vouchers for health care, let's talk a little bit about what that really means. And when we talk about privatizing Social Security, let's get into a little bit more detail about what that is. Because I don't think these are concepts that should be dismissed easily as being negative or wrong or evil. I think everyone deserves to know more about what those things might actually do for us and how we need to reform. We cannot continue the way we are. This absolutely cannot be done. And so for those who say, I don't want to change anything about Medicare, I don't want to change anything about Social Security, I don't believe that's realistic. We've got to make changes.
Thank you, Colonel. Congressman?
Thank you, Joel. Good evening, and I too want to thank the sponsors for tonight's debate and UWL's hospitality. And it's been a joy to be able to campaign with Ray Bolin. I wish all the campaigns around the nation could be as civil and as respectful as ours. In our thoughts and prayers, I echo Ray's sentiments to the victims of Hurricane Nancy. It's times like this when you see the true greatness of our nation, when it's all hands on deck and we have to pull together as one nation, as one country, and come to the needs of others. And I'm confident that that will be done in light of this tragedy. And we are 1 week out from November 6th, and we do face a very important choice. And I think I speak on behalf of all the people here in the state of Wisconsin. Thank God we're down to 1 week of campaigning here in the state, because I don't think we can take much more with all the outside expenditures coming in and all the negativity. And it's been too bitter for too long in our political system. It's been too polarized. The hyper-partisanship has not been conducive to good policymaking or for the effort to find common ground. That's how I've tried to conduct myself in representing my home area here in western Wisconsin, to sit down and listen to each other and try to find that common ground that I know exists out there. We face some big challenges. An economy that's not there yet, coming out of the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, but we do face a very distinct and sharp choice come November 6th. Now, we can double down on the policies of the past, which drove us into this economic mess, doubling down on trickle-down. Another $5 trillion tax break that's being proposed under the Romney-Ryan budget, which will primarily benefit the most wealthy, expecting it to trickle down and somehow strengthen middle-class working families. The problem is it didn't work in the past. And I think it's fundamentally unfair and wrong that we've got multimillionaires and multi-billionaires paying a lower effective tax rate in this country than most working families are. And I think it's fundamentally wrong that most small businesses in our country, and right here in Wisconsin, are paying a higher rate than most multinationals. Yet that's what's been happening with the policies coming out of Washington. I think it's also wrong to pull the referees off the field and allow these Wall Street banks to act like casinos again. And that's exactly what my opponent and Romney Ryan are proposing in repealing the financial reform, which finally puts the referees back on the field and to provide proper oversight to make sure that those Wall Street banks are acting like banks and not like casinos with our money again. And I think it's wrong in their budget, too, that they're trying to increase defense spending by an additional $2 trillion when we've withdrawn all our forces from Iraq and we're trying to expedite the withdrawal of our forces from Afghanistan. And if anyone here standing before you claiming to be fiscally responsible says that the path forward for economic prosperity and success for our country is another $5 trillion worth of tax breaks, primarily for the most wealthy, and an additional $2 trillion of spending in defense, they're not leveling with you because the math doesn't add up. I think there are better ways to invest in our country that will lead to job creation and economic growth, starting right here on campus, making sure that our students have access to a quality education, quality job training programs, the investment in basic and applied research, the expansion of broadband to every inch of our territory, and the modernization that our infrastructure needs. These are things we can do tomorrow if we can reach agreement on it. And guess what? They're going to create jobs tomorrow, too, and lay the groundwork for long-term sustainable economic growth, which is exactly what our nation needs right now.
A quick comment. I think it's wrong that we have billionaires and millionaires receiving Social Security and Medicare payment. And I use those as two quick examples of how so many things need major work. Our entitlement programs need major reform, and that's just a couple of examples of why.
And just to respond, Ray, I'm one who's been advocating reform with the entitlement programs. In fact, healthcare reform will change the way Medicare is delivered in our country, and especially how we pay for it. We can no longer afford these volume-based payments in our healthcare system, leading to more tests, more procedures that aren't benefiting people and improving the quality of care. Those tools are involved in the healthcare reform measure, and they're based on models of care that are happening right here in our own backyard with Gunderson, with Mayo, with Marshfield and Dean. So we don't have to recreate the wheel, but you're exactly right that those spending programs are in need of reform. The question is, what's the proper way of doing it without undermining the security that Medicare and Social Security provide seniors throughout the state of Wisconsin and our country? They earn those programs. We should be fighting to preserve them, not to privatize them.
Okay, first question comes from Chris Hardy of La Crosse Tribune.
The federal deficit for the fiscal year that ended September 30th was $1.089 trillion, and our federal debt has passed the $16 trillion mark. How do we move to budgets with surpluses rather than deficits and chip away at the staggering debt total?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Chris, because any candidate running for federal office should have answers to that, specific answers where they would go to in the budget for cost savings. Let me give you three. The largest and fastest growing area of spending, bar none, is rising health care costs. So any candidate, again, running for office that doesn't have ideas and solutions on how we can bring those costs down is being unrealistic in how we manage these unsustainable budget deficits. And they are unsustainable. We can't afford this red ink that's been piling up for too long. And for healthcare reform, again, to move forward, it's really three major components: the build-out of health information technology and electronic medical records, which can improve the efficiency of care and bring costs down. It's changing the way healthcare is delivered, so it's more integrated, coordinated, patient-centered. Again, those models that exist right here in western Wisconsin that are producing some of the best results in the world, but at a good price. And then finally, changing the way we pay for it. So it's based on the value or the outcome of care given and not the volume of services rendered. A recent Institute of Medicine report came out a couple of weeks ago that showed that we spent over $750 billion in the healthcare system this past year on tests and procedures and things that don't work. We can't afford that anymore. And in defense, it makes no sense that we have 80,000 troops still stationed in Western Europe guarding against the Russian invasion that's not going to happen in our lifetime. Or weapons programs have a $300 billion cost overrun because of change orders and contract revisions. So this blank check that defense contractors expect from the American taxpayer can't continue. We can't afford that. And I've been one of the leading voices on farm bill reform to end the huge taxpayer subsidies going to big agribusiness that does not benefit our family farmers. It's leading to more consolidation in production agriculture, and it's not fiscally responsible. So those are three big spending items I would look to first for cost savings in order to deal with these budget deficits.
Colonel Boland.
Well, first of all, with regards to health care and the costs of health care and the models that the Congressman talked about, for the most part, those models are not at all at work in the Medicare and Medicaid arena. We know that that's where there's huge waste going on, and it's because we don't have, for the most part, patient-centered care, quality control, electronic records keeping, and all the things he's talked about. And so back to the point about vouchers for health care, I think what Congressman Ryan is talking about there is exactly what the Congressman has just said: get more people into managed care that's patient-centered. And that's why we have so much waste going on in healthcare. With respect to defense, and I know you have this favorite example about troops that we still have in Europe. I thought for a moment there you might start on horses and bayonets.
No, not going to go there. I won't go there.
I was stationed in Europe a couple of times. I have a little bit of a feel for what goes on over there. At the height of the Cold War, we had 250,000 troops in Europe, and now we're down to in the area of 80,000, and some good reasons why we still have those troops there. Been an important part of supporting our effort in the Middle East, and an important part of helping train and work with our new emerging allies in Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia and Poland particularly. There's two of the brigades that we had in Europe that are being eliminated from the force completely, and I would have argued to move one of those brigades to Fort McCoy, where it could have been kept in the force at lower cost and be very combat ready, and add to and use the facilities we have at Fort McCoy in a much better way.
Joe, may I respond?
Go ahead.
But Ray, these are the tough choices we face. You know, with the chronic budget deficits that Chris just pointed out, we can't afford to have those troops deployed overseas for a long time. You know those forward deployments are very expensive. And I don't think it's right to be trying to find cost savings in the healthcare system by privatizing Medicare, creating this voucher program that doesn't keep up with healthcare expenses and merely shifts the cost of that healthcare onto the backs of our seniors who can least afford it. There are better ways of finding efficiencies and cost savings within the entire healthcare system, which would also benefit the Medicare program and bring those costs down, but without cost shifting and asking our seniors to bear the entire risk within the healthcare system, which is exactly what the Ryan Romney plan proposes that you apparently embrace.
And you know, that's another scare tactic assumption that's made, that it's going to cost more. And the evidence for that is not clear at all. We know that in across the board, in most cases, managed care is producing savings. It's not driving the cost up. And there's obviously much more competition in the managed care arena. So I'm having trouble picturing why costs are going to go up when providers would actually be competing for the business of people who want to buy a managed plan. I'd like to see our citizens in Wisconsin have health care plans like our state employees do and the people that are in the state system. I was in that system. And those are great coverage programs, but that's not what we have in Medicare today.
Okay, we're going to move on. Jane Claycap, sure. League of Women Voters.
This was alluded to in the opening remarks, and it was talked about the cost of elections. Do you support efforts to increase transparency and provide more information to the public through such steps as requiring disclosure and quick reporting of all election-related spending?
I do. And I think you're looking at a candidate that's living proof of telling everything there is to tell. I believe that, and I think we all agree, that the whole question of finance in campaigns, the huge amounts of money that are being raised, the special interest groups that are involved, that's an area I'd like to see plenty of reform and more openness or transparency. So, yes.
Well, that's refreshing, because the Republican colleagues who I work with in Washington are dead set against any type of transparency, which is unfortunate. Because Citizens United, that Supreme Court decision, will be the bane of our democracy. We're seeing it here in Wisconsin. Millions of dollars pouring in from powerful outside special interests, including a few very wealthy individuals. And we don't have a clue where all this money is coming from because of the lack of transparency. And I've been proud to be able to co-sponsor the Disclose Act, which would require at a minimum that this money has to be fully disclosed so that the American people can be the ultimate referee and decide for themselves what the motivation is behind all this spending. You know, we get some little nuggets like the Adelson couple in Vegas, the casino magnates that are doubling down at tens of millions of dollars in that. But we don't know where all this money is coming from. And I hate to see a huge finance scandal be the impetus behind Congress's action. Because for years, it was Ray's party that said there should be unlimited amounts of money in campaigns as long as it's fully disclosed. Well, they got the unlimited amounts through the Supreme Court decision, and now they're fighting full disclosure, which I think is wrong. The American people deserve to know that information. We as candidates have to disclose every contribution that comes to us. We have to file it electronically. These outside expenditures and special PACs, they should have to do the same thing.
Next question comes from Mike Thompson.
Well, you both alluded to this, but I want to know if you do or do not agree with privatizing Social Security, what changes would you make?
Congressman Kine.
I do not think that would be wise policy to privatize Social Security, but you know, let's just remember recent history. Back in 2005, 2006, the Bush administration made a major push to privatize the Social Security system, to put that money into the stock market. Along comes the fall of 2008. $17 trillion of wealth was destroyed almost overnight. And if that money was into the equities market at that time, goodbye. That lifetime security that 70% of seniors, Mike, in Western Wisconsin rely upon as their primary, if not sole source of retirement security, would have been in great jeopardy. The seniors paid into it, they earned it. That program deserves to be protected, but it's not completely solvent over the next 75 years. But it's also not on the verge of going bankrupt, as a lot of politicians want to scare seniors about. If we do nothing, and I'm not proposing we do nothing to reform Social Security, we can still live up to 75% of the guaranteed benefits under Social Security for the next 75 years. So that's hardly a program on the verge of going bankrupt. But there is a shortfall, and we should be looking at a combination of factors from indexing to, as Ray pointed out a little bit earlier, means testing the Social Security program in order to make sure it's there for those who need it the most, I think are subjects that need to be thoroughly discussed.
Carolyn Boland.
Yes, well, first of all, I think we probably need to redefine what Social Security is all about, because I think it's wandered a great distance from where it began. From my recollection in the early beginning, Social Security was intended as a safety net program for those who were really in desperate need, and we needed to help them, and we still need to help them. But if it's a retirement program, which seems to have become a primary retirement program for many people, then we need to treat it as a retirement program. What's one of the best retirement programs in the country? Right here in Wisconsin. The state retirement program. And all of that money is invested. The State of Wisconsin Investment Board continues to get the highest ratings in the country for its sound management of those investments. Now, I was in that program, and I know a lot of other state employees, and they're also paying, having payroll deduction for Social Security. I'd be willing to bet, and I know how I'd answer the question if I was asked it, If I had the choice for my payroll deduction from Social Security to go into the investment account with the State Investment Board, I'd do that right away, rather than throw it in the Treasury where it's all going to be spent, it's not going to be there later, it's not invested, and there's nothing else to show for it down the road.
Joe.
So there you have it. Most retirement accounts are invested, and I see absolutely no reason why we can't do that with a Social Security option.
Well, I think what Ray is proposing would be a very dangerous proposal, especially at the federal level with the Social Security funds, because his party especially hates the idea of picking winners and losers. But once you start setting up a pension retirement board like that, they're going to be investing in individual stocks and individual companies. And who gets chosen and who doesn't gets politicized very, very quickly. Right now, the Social Security surplus is invested in Treasury notes and bonds, the safest vehicle that there is throughout the world. At the height of our financial crisis, where was all the money being poured into, both domestically and abroad? Into T-notes and bonds because of the full faith and credit of the United States of America that backs up those payments. And that's where the surplus Social Security funds are, which we can rely upon. That won't go bankrupt. That won't go away, unlike the extreme risk that exists in the equities market, the stock market, as we've seen now over the last 4 years.
Next question from Scott Hackworth goes to Colonel Boland.
The Bush tax cuts are due to expire early next year. The cost is estimated, if they are extended, to $1 trillion over the next 10 years. Would you support extending the Bush tax cuts? Would you support modifying benefits from them?
Well, I think from most of what I hear, and there's, of course, lots of analysis going on about this, that the worst thing that could happen right now for our country is tax increases. And throughout our district and throughout the country, that is the biggest fear of small business particularly. And of course, right now, we have so much uncertainty about what will happen with taxes that we have a very low level of confidence throughout our economy. We have low level of confidence with employers, investors, consumers, and so on. So in general, it seems to me it's the wrong time to raise taxes. Whether or not they should be increased only for those over a certain income level versus others, it seems to me gets into the class warfare area again. And I don't know what the evidence would be that increasing those tax rates is necessarily going to increase revenue. I think the problem most people would agree with now is that the existing tax rates are probably high enough. We just have too much avoidance of paying the taxes that people should pay now, and that gets you into loopholes and the need for tax reform. So I think we should be looking at how do we get more revenue out of getting more people to pay their fair share of taxes than necessarily how do we get more by raising the tax rate.
Ray, this isn't about class warfare. This is about being fair and about being reasonable in addressing our budget deficits. Well, again, let's recall recent history. There were two major tax cuts that were passed in the early 20s, 2000s, and none of them were paid for, not a nickel. We went to war with two separate countries, and not a nickel of it was paid for. There was the largest expansion of entitlement spending, a new prescription drug program for seniors back in 2004, 2005. As $1 trillion worth of cost, not a nickel of it was paid for. And that's one of the reasons why we're in these chronic budget deficits today, because of the unwillingness to pay for things. And I have yet to see one proposal that calls for the extension or the permanent extension of the Bush tax cuts that would pay for it at the same time. That, again, is a recipe for economic decline because of huge budget deficits that will ensue. Now, I think the president's approach is a reasonable one. For those earning less than $250,000 a year, we should not be raising taxes on them because it includes 98% of small businesses. But I just have a problem knowing that there are multimillionaires and billionaires in this country paying a lower effective tax rate than most working families are. Or that you get a company like GE that didn't pay any tax at all. And I can't walk into any small business here in western Wisconsin with a straight face and try to explain that to them, that they're paying more than most multinationals are. And the tax code is riddled with these special protections. But here's the problem, and I don't know if Ray is guilty of it himself, but too many of my colleagues are signing these no new revenue pledges from any source for any reason, period. And therefore, you can't reform the tax code. You can't shut down offshore tax havens. You can't stop companies from benefiting through tax breaks, sending jobs overseas, because they consider that all new revenue. And again, that is not going to help us come to grips with the budget deficits that we face today.
Next question comes from John Davis, WLSU.
The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's come to be known, is it good or bad? And if you're against it, is there anything worth keeping in it? And if you support it, how can it be improved upon?
The first major problem with Obamacare or the Affordable Health Care Act is that's quite unaffordable. That's a basic problem. And let's be reminded that 40% of everything the government, federal government's doing right now, 40% of every dollar it's spending is borrowed. And that's in everything. And so when you stop and think about the fact, and I've had arguments with seniors about, well, wait a minute, Social Security isn't 40% borrowed, we're contributing to that. And Medicare isn't 40% borrowed because we're contributing to that. Well, we are contributing to those things, and we're not contributing enough. But you can spread that 40% anywhere you want to. If you say, well, Medicare's pretty much paid for, then you might say, well, all of Medicaid isn't paid for at all. That's all borrowed. There's nobody contributing to Medicaid. And for those of you who don't know what Medicaid is, that's health care that we provide free to the disabled and the very poor. And we should continue doing that, but there's a lot of other people receiving so-called free health care in Medicaid, and we don't have the money now. And by every estimate that I see, Obamacare is going to add. It's going to add more people to free health care. Where's the money going to come from? More taxing of the rich. Okay, that's one answer. But we're talking about huge amounts of money here. And until we start dealing with the fact that 40% of everything we're doing now is borrowed, it's very difficult to get to the rest of it.
Congressman? John, I supported the Affordable Care Act because I felt the status quo was unsustainable. If we did nothing, we knew what it would bring. Rising health care costs for all Americans. But public budget deficits continue to explode because of the huge costs of health care. Our businesses, large and small, less able to compete globally because of rising health care costs. And more people becoming uninsured in our country. And I've never claimed that the Affordable Care Act was a perfect bill, but there were enough tools in it to start reforming a healthcare system that was in desperate need of reform. We couldn't sustain the status quo any longer. And there are a lot of important things, benefits that are occurring right now that people are feeling. If you're a child with a pre-existing condition, you can no longer be denied health care. I'll never forget that young mother who came up and told me that her little boy Henry, before he was born, suffered a seizure in her womb, and therefore the first breath he took during his life, he was uninsurable because he had a pre-existing condition. We're better than that as a nation, and I know we can do better. But the key to healthcare reform is to find out what's working and what isn't, and then having the ability to make changes. Seniors today are getting a 50% price discount under the prescription drug bill because we were finally able to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. Small businesses are getting a 35% tax credit for the health care that they are providing their workers. That goes up to 50% in 2014. Young adults can stay on their parents' plans now until 26. And perhaps most importantly, there are tools in health care reform to start changing the way health care is delivered and how we pay for it. So it is based on value, not volume. That, I think, is the most realistic hope of bringing costs down so it's affordable for everyone. But unfortunately, the Republican plan doesn't even address these issues. And in fact, what they're calling for changes in Medicare won't even happen for another 10 years. And if their plan's so good, why doesn't it start now? We sure. can't afford to wait around another 10 years before there are any changes in the healthcare system.
Short response?
One quick response. Congressman, if you really believe that Obamacare is going to lower health care costs overall, you are one of the few people I've met that believes that.
Well, Joe, let me respond. It's not me believing it or not.
We just said that.
Go talk to Gunderson. Go talk to Mayo. Go talk to Marshfield. Go talk to Dean. These are the models of care that are embedded in the Affordable Care Act that we're trying to take system-wide. They're convinced that based on the quality of care that they're providing, that those models can significantly reduce health care costs. And let me just address one myth that Reagan perpetrated tonight. The Affordable Care Act was completely paid for. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, in looking at it through the revenue and the spending reductions that are part of the bill, said that it will reduce the budget deficit by $1.2 trillion over the next 20 years. I know that's a little alien with a lot of my Republican colleagues actually paying for a piece of legislation rather than adding to the debt, but that's the CBO score, and they are the official referee with everything that we do.
One quick, very short. You keep referring to the Republican Party and my party and my colleagues. I want to remind you, it is I who is here tonight, not the rest of the Republican Party.
But you
party.
Embraced and the I have my Ryan
own,
budget.
I have my own views on some of these things.
But didn't you embrace the Ryan budget plan?
Yes.
I mean, that's why I'm referring in the collective here, Ray.
Okay.
From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, you're listening to Newsmakers in a UW-La Crosse debate featuring the candidates for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, incumbent Democrat Ron Kind of La Crosse and Republican challenger Ray Boland of Sparta.
Our next question comes from the audience. And let's see. Higher education and students have been under considerable fiscal stress with loans at record levels. Do you support any proposals to deal with this problem? This question goes to Congressman Kind.
Yeah, getting back to the Romney-Ryan budget that, again, my opponent embraced, I think the wrong path forward as far as getting this economy on track, creating good-paying jobs, is to make it harder for students to go to school. And that's exactly what they're proposing, with deep cuts to the Pell Grant program, to the work-study program, to TRIO and Gear Up, to the McNair scholarships that exist right here on campus, and also the basic research that I had a chance to personally look at here at UWL and the other 5 campuses in this congressional district. Those, I think, are important public investments we have to make. In essence, planting the seed corn so we can reap a bountiful harvest a little bit later on. But their budget calls to undermine the financial aid programs that students depend upon. And in fact, the budget that Ray, again, embraced just a moment ago called for a doubling of student loan interest rates from 3.4 up to 6.8% in order to help pay for their tax breaks within their budget. I think that's wrong. Not when the average undergraduate here in Wisconsin is graduating with close to $25,000, $26,000 worth of debt, a deep financial hole just when they're starting their families, just when they're starting their careers. I know personally, as a kid who grew up on the north side of La Crosse, my parents couldn't afford college for me, so I had to take out Pell Grants. I did work study. I took out student loans and incurred that personal debt. I think I still hold the record for most toilets cleaned in a 4-year undergraduate career. It was the worst job on campus, but it also paid the best under work study. And I did that for 4 years. And it was through a combination of those programs that I was able to go to school and obtain a college degree. I want to make sure that every student around here has that same opportunity that I have and that we're not undermining their economic future.
Colonel Boland.
You may hold a record for cleaning toilets, but I can tell you I hold a record for how long it takes to get a college degree. Because I had to work part-time constantly to do it. It took me 10 years to get my bachelor's degree and another 10 years to get my master's degree. The Army interfered with that a little bit along the way. But I can tell you, I appreciate very much the cost of education and what it takes. So I think some questions about where that money comes from, the extent to which the federal government should be involved in providing funding versus state governments and local governments. I fought very hard when I was in state government to get a tuition grant benefit for our veterans here in Wisconsin. And we achieved that. And we knew that by providing some tuition assistance for our veterans, they would have a fighting chance of being able to go to school and afford it, because so many of them are married and have some of the problems I had along the way trying to do that. So I'm a strong supporter of education and providing educational opportunities and benefits. It's a question of where does the money come from, which pots are we talking about, and how much of that should be accomplished at the state level versus federal.
Okay, the next question comes from Chris Hardy, the Tribune. It goes to Colonel Boland.
The Middle East continues to be a foreign policy dilemma for our country. Do you support the way that the United States has dealt with Iran, and if not, how should that change?
I think it's extremely important that we get some more focus on the fact that peace and stability in the Middle East is a long-term proposition. I mean, we're all happy to see our troops come out of Afghanistan, and we're happy for them to come out of Iraq. But those developments are not take our ball and go home time. I mean, we've got to have a long-term strategy and commitment to that region to work in building new partnerships and security arrangements and with these new emerging allies and new governments. With respect to Iran, we've got a particular problem there. And I thought the Prime Minister of Israel put it very well in his testimony to the United Nations when he said, you know, the difference with having a nuclear weapon in the hands of the Iranians very different than what it was our standoff with the Soviets. Because the Soviets valued life. And when things came down to the crunch point in those days, they were able to make rational decisions. And we have a possibility now of a nuclear weapon being in the hands of people who give every appearance of not valuing life, in some instances valuing death, and appear to be quite incapable of making rational decisions in urgent situations. So I am not trigger happy. I don't think we should preemptively act in Iran right now, but we have to keep a very close eye, along with our allies, on what happens there, and we cannot let them gain a nuclear weapon.
Congressman Kine.
Chris, I have supported the President's policy of economic and diplomatic isolationism as it relates to Iran. And this has always been difficult for us because we haven't had a presence on the ground or any type of relationship with that country. And yet the President, when he first came to office, it was a very disjointed coalition out there as far as economic support for economic sanctions or even diplomatic isolation against Iran. We've come a long ways the last 4 years of being able to bring other nations aboard, including Russia and China, the two nations that do have some leverage over Iran, who have been supporting increased diplomatic and economic pressure on Iran itself. I think that's the right course of action to take. There are other instruments at our in our control that can also help undermine Iran's capacity to develop that nuclear capability. But I also agree with Ray. I think a nuclearized Iran is bad for the region, and it's bad for global security. Once they develop the capability of having the bomb, other nations in that area will want it the next day. And now you're in a region of the world. We have countries living next to each other who don't like each other very well. And you arm them with nuclear weapons and trigger points, and bad things can happen. So I am appreciative of what the President's been able to accomplish over the last 4 years of increased economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. Hopefully, Iran will realize that it's in their best interest to be a responsible member of the global community rather than pursuing nuclear capability. And we need to keep the pressure on. But the only way that's going to happen is through a multilateral effort. Us acting alone won't be able to accomplish it.
Next question comes from Jay Klinkheim, Believe Women Voters, and goes to, Congressman Kine.
It seems that most people would agree that the economy and jobs are important, and if you were elected, you would focus on those two things. If you are elected, what would be your major priorities for the next Congress?
Thanks, Jane. A few of them. I think we have to keep the number one, number two, number three priority on economic growth and job creation, good-paying jobs, those that can sustain working families. That's why I've been supportive of numerous small business initiatives. Immediate expensing. For any investment a small business makes in their business, they can immediately expense that year instead of stretching it out over a period of years. I've been supportive of tax credits for health care that small businesses are providing their workers. I think that can alleviate the financial burden. I have yet to walk into a small business who wouldn't want the ability to pay for or help pay for the health care of their employees. They want to do the right thing, but it's hard given their margins in that. I've also been supportive of certain investments I know will lead to short-term job creation, but lays the groundwork for an economy built to last, for long-term economic growth. That's the investment in the quality education for our students, job training programs, where there's a skills gap today developing between the jobs being created, especially in advanced manufacturing, and what the workforce is offering. The expansion of broadband connection is crucial for any business where they're going to locate, including rural areas throughout western Wisconsin. The infrastructure investment that we have to make. And let me tell you something else. We have to be doing this now because other nations are. I'll guarantee you that China, Brazil, India, Russia would like to see nothing better than for us to gut our support for education at home, or to allow our infrastructure to crumble, or for us to pull back on crucial scientific and medical and technological research in this country, because they're doing it, and they want to overtake us as economic global powers. And shame on us if we allow that to happen.
Colonel Boland?
The first thing we have to do, the absolute top priority, I have no doubt about this, so we have to balance our federal budget. Same countries he's talking about are looking at us right now, watching us self-destruct financially. They're watching how we're borrowing 40% of everything we're doing, and they're just biding their time. When you look at the national elements of power, and this is something I've studied for a long time, when you talk about military power and economic power and political power, the importance of maintaining our economic element of power is crucial, and it's eroding. It's unraveling before us. And so That's why nothing's happening in our economy. In part, the situation to me is very much like it was 30 years ago when President Reagan was elected. And at that time, all the economists were saying, and of course, at that time, we had much worse economic factors other than the national debt. We had double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, double-digit employment. And everyone was saying, the thing we need is confidence. No one has confidence in anything anymore. And the only thing that can change that is leadership. And that's the single thing that President Reagan brought to the equation. Leadership that restored confidence, that removed uncertainty, and got things going again. And that's what we need now. We've got to balance that budget. We're going to have some leadership, both in the White House and in the Congress, that's committed to doing that and has the will and the ability to get it done.
Ray, I would agree with that. But we also have to walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, you got to go after the big spending programs if we're going to be serious about the budget. And that's healthcare spending, it's defense, it's those programs I talked about earlier. But if you go after education and job training and broadband and basic research and infrastructure, that is a recipe for economic decline rather than economic success. And that's exactly what the Romney-Ryan budget is proposing to do, to undermine our ability to lay the groundwork for long-term growth and to ensure those doors of opportunity are left open for all Americans, not just for a few.
Mike Thompson, WKBT.
The five-year farm bill expired at the end of September because of the inaction of Congress. What changes do you propose to this farm bill?
Ray.
Well, I think this is one area that the congressman and I have a fair amount of agreement on. We agree we need a new farm bill. We agree that modernization is badly needed, particularly in the subsidy programs. I am very concerned about the way the food stamp program and this huge growth that's taking place with it sort of dominates the perspective of what's going on at the farm bill. I think that needs to be completely separate. I think food stamps needs to be put in the public assistance arena where it can be viewed alongside of welfare and other public assistance and get it out of the farm bill picture. With regards to subsidies, there are some that we need to keep. And we have to keep our eye on conservation and maintaining good stewardship of our land. But there are big subsidies, and I think this is the one both of us have talked about, where there are people who are not farming. They're drawing large amounts of money for land that is unproductive. Many of the farmers I've talked to are talking about getting more land in our district to be productive, to capitalize on the growing markets we have for our agricultural products. And a great potential to do that, but we need more land to be productive, and some of it that's just sitting there needs to get converted.
Congressman Kind.
Mike, we need a five-year farm bill. It was inexcusable that the House leadership even refused to bring the bill up for consideration before it had a chance to expire. The drought conditions that we experienced throughout the country, our farmers need to know what to expect over the next 5 years. And there was no reason why we couldn't bring the bill to the floor and have people like me offer amendments to reform and change it and hopefully make a better farm bill at the end of the day. And it was the lack of that leadership that was the only impediment to bringing it. The Senate already passed their farm bill. They did their work. We need the House to step up right now, too. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity yet this year to do it. But I've been one of the leading advocates of changing some of these outdated 1930, 1940 programs that make no sense for the 21st century. These huge taxpayer subsidies going to benefit a few but very big agribusiness, that's not helping production agriculture. It's not helping our family farmers. It's not making it easier for new beginning farmers to enter the occupation when we need it. And it's not fiscally responsible. And yet I see the same errors being made with the House version of the Farm Bill, setting target prices now with record high commodity prices. So all it would take is a little dip in the price and there'd be huge taxpayer subsidies going out the door again. Or the huge taxpayer support for insurance premiums. In effect, what that would result in is the socializing the losses and the privatizing of profits, and it would take all risk out of farming. And it would enable farmers to plant in fallow areas, highly sensitive and highly erodible land, knowing that if there's crop failure, and there will be, the American taxpayer will be there with huge insurance payouts at the end of the day. And I think it's very dangerous to take risk out of farming, and yet those are some of the proposals that are in the House version that I hope to change before it becomes law.
Next question.
A quick comment. And I appreciate the advocacy you've expressed in this area. But I've got to say also that throughout our district, many farmers are really disappointed that you haven't been able to get more done on this. You've been there a long time. The Republicans haven't always controlled the House. And farmers believe that by this time, you might have established more of a position of leadership to be able to get more done.
Ray, some of the farmers don't like what I'm doing because they're the recipients of some of these subsidies. And that's the tough call that I've been making. And it's the type of leadership I've been providing. It's having to say no to some production interests right here in Wisconsin because I don't think that is the right policy to go forward. And I'm going to continue that, even if it comes with political peril, and it has. I've got the battle scars to prove going up against these entrenched agricultural interests, these powerful interests in Washington. They've made me public enemy number one as far as their interests are concerned, but I think it's a fight worth having because production agriculture is the number one industry in Wisconsin. It employs more people directly or indirectly than any other business we have, and they deserve a fair shake coming out of Washington than what they've been getting.
Next question, Scott Hackworth, and goes to Congressman Kind.
From an issue where there was some agreement between the two of you to a question that there will be no common ground, I suspect, and that's the issue of abortion. I want to ask it this way, though. Congressman Kind, you're pro-choice, but do you feel there should be any restrictions to unfettered access to abortion? And Colonel Boland, you're pro-life, but do you feel there should be any exceptions to a ban on abortion?
Scott, there already is. Under the Roe decision, second and third trimester, there's a strict scrutiny test that's already applied, so it's not just abortion at will. But I think it's wrong to put a government bureaucrat in the way of a woman and her doctor and her spouse and her clergy. I think that is such a fundamentally private right that they possess that a bunch of politicians in Washington shouldn't be dictating how women should be able to control their body. I think that's just basic. But I also think that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And there's more common ground to try to prevent unwanted pregnancies to begin with. That means making sure that women, if they want access to contraceptive, have access to it. We found that when they do, unwanted pregnancies plummet, and therefore the abortion rate plummets along with it. I think that's just common policy that, unfortunately, there hasn't been enough discussion to find that common ground in order to reduce unwanted pregnancies to begin with. But I certainly don't support any policy that's going to put any type of bureaucrat or insurance company in between a woman and her doctor.
Colonel Boland.
Well, my feeling that is that these are areas that government should not have much role in at all. I think there's some very personal decisions involved that people have to make, and then they have to live with those decisions. I am pro-life. I'm opposed to abortion, but I don't have to make that decision personally. But I don't want bureaucrats making it for someone else. I agree with that point. With regards to contraception, that there again, it's a very personal matter. I don't think government has any role in that area whatsoever.
Joe, let me just say, what I see is a very troubling trend going on in Washington these days, especially the effort through legislation to try to redefine rape. Give me a break. I was a former prosecutor here in western Wisconsin. I handled a lot of sexual assault cases and that. And this effort now in Washington that even vice presidential candidate Ryan put his name to, that Todd Akin sponsored, is beyond the pale. I don't understand why they would try to do that, because sexual violence is a serious matter in our communities and in our society. And their efforts to try to undermine that, I think, is inexcusable, and I will fight that until my last breath.
Okay, the next question comes from John Davis, and I'd like the candidates to stick to one-minute answers, please.
Immigration reform is another of those issues. It's been out there for years with no compromise. Do immigration laws need reform, and what should that look like?
Yes, we are in desperate need of immigration reform. And this is the proverbial kicking the can down the road. And it hasn't helped us economically, nor has it provided clear lines as far as what people looking to enter our country legally should expect. I'm a big proponent of legal immigration. I think those who do enter our country illegally need to suffer the consequences of the laws that they violated. But the idea that we're going to somehow marshal the resources to go out and identify over 12 million undocumented people in this country and somehow ship them out, or as Mitt Romney is proposing, just have them voluntarily exit our country, is unrealistic. And I hear this from businesses here in western Wisconsin too, especially agriculture, farmers. that rely on immigrant labor in order to harvest their crops and to get the chores done. So I think there are ways, and hopefully in a bipartisan fashion, to try to find some common ground to reform an immigration system that is in desperate need again. Yes, we have to enforce our laws. Yes, we have to do more to secure our own border. There are national security implications. Yes, we should hold businesses accountable when they are knowingly hiring illegal people to work there. But we need a comprehensive solution, and unfortunately, it's been too politicized for too long.
Ray?
We definitely need to enforce the immigration laws we have now, and that includes sealing the border. I think that's within our capability, and we should do that. I agree that there and farmers throughout our district talk about how they couldn't function. Our dairy industry could not function without all of the immigrant labor that is here now. So we have to have reasonable approaches to this, and I agree that there are work permit solutions to good workers, and we need to continue those. But there are a lot of people here who shouldn't be here. They're not productive. There are criminals. There are others that need to go back.
Okay, the next question comes from the audience, and I'd like to keep at least under a minute for the response. It goes to Ray. Mitt Romney has called for an abolishment of FEMA. Would you support or oppose such a measure?
I have never, I have quite a bit of experience with FEMA. I've never been a big fan of the efficiency of that organization. On the contrary, and we have many examples of failures of FEMA to do the job it's supposed to in the first place. I haven't really thought about completely abolishing it, but I certainly would give that favorable consideration because I think FEMA is overall a failed concept.
Ron?
I think the abolishment of FEMA would be a disaster. Maybe not a natural disaster that they're supposed to be trained to address, but it would be very foolish. I don't know a state that would have the resources themselves in order to deal with a catastrophe like Hurricane Nancy. And we here in western Wisconsin have directly benefited from FEMA with recent flooding that has happened in our own communities. You can go down to the various towns and counties that were impacted adversely just in recent years, and they'll tell you how FEMA was able to step up and provide help to businesses and homeowners alike. And that's what we do as a nation. When a natural disaster hits, we pull together. We come together as one people in order to help each other out. We may not be in Hurricane Alley or Tornado Alley. We're in Flood Alley, actually, ourselves. But there's no state that can handle the magnitude of these disasters with the finances that they have available unless the federal government, through an agency like FEMA, is willing to step in and provide that assistance. We're seeing that happen right now throughout the East Coast.
We're now going to go into closing statements, 2 minutes each, and Congressman Kind, you're going to go first.
Well, thank you, Joe. Again, I want to thank the sponsors for tonight's debate, and I want to thank Colonel Boland for the tenure of the campaign. Again, I wish all campaigns throughout the nation could have a serious discussion of the issues rather than the senseless attacks that we see on the air. And we have a weird way of electing our representatives of the country, where the goal is just to tear each other down so no one has any credibility at all at the end of the day. And then we're supposed to come together and address the big challenges that we face. And I think it's unfortunate. And getting back to, Jane, your question on big money in politics, I think it's one of the reasons we see these type of campaigns being waged. But I think we do face a very fundamental choice come November 6th, or for you early voters in that. It's a choice of two different directions. We can go back to the failed policies of the past that drove us into this economic ditch, or we can come together and start working to improve this nation and find the common ground that I know exists. I'm perhaps the only member of Congress who's commemorating the 150th anniversary of the 37th Congress that met for 6 weeks during the summer of 1862. A time of great economic and military peril. We weren't even sure if the Republic would even survive during that first full year of the Civil War, let alone what it would look like. But that Congress met, and they passed the Morrill Act, which established the land-grant public university system that we have throughout our country today, including right here on this campus. They passed the Pacific Railroad Act that established the first transcontinental transportation and communication system for our country. They passed the Homestead Act, which opened up the land out west for the pioneers and settlers. They authorized the creation of the National Academy of Sciences, who still do great research and make great policy recommendations today. And they also passed the first personal income tax so we would finance the Civil War effort instead of driving our nation into debt and bankruptcy. And that's a legacy of accomplishment that we still feel today. And that's the choice that we really face as a nation. Where are those important public investments that still need to be made, even during tough economic times? Where are those areas of the budget that are ripe for reform and for spending reductions? And there's where I think there's a fundamental difference of vision of where our nation needs to go and whether those doors of opportunity are going to be left open for all Americans and whether America's best days are still ahead. I believe that.
I think there are really two fundamental questions that you need to decide as voters with regards to the two of us. First is policy. Do you agree with the congressman that the policies of the current administration and continuing those are the best course for the country? Or do you believe, as I do, that major reforms are needed in order to get our financial house in order? The other question is performance. Congressman has been there 16 years. I mentioned that a moment ago. And he has not been held to any particular performance standard. I've spent a lifetime in jobs where performance was measured constantly. And one of the expressions I dislike the most is when we hear about the Congress kicking the can down the road. The jobs I've had, there was no place to kick the can, whether that was in combat, on the border in Europe, planning the removal of Noriega from Panama. Every mission I've been given, I've been expected to complete, and I have. And that's why tonight I'm asking all of the voters in this district to give me their vote. Give me a chance to serve you in Washington. And I promise I won't let you down. Because I'm used to working with other people. I have a track record of getting things done with other people. And that's what I'll do in Washington. Thank you.
I'd like to thank our candidates, Congressman Kind and Colonel Bowen.
You've been listening to a UW-La Crosse-hosted political debate featuring candidates for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District race on Wisconsin Public Radio. The candidates are incumbent Democrat Ron Kind of La Crosse and Republican challenger Colonel Ray Boland of Sparta. The moderator was UWL political science professor Joe Heim. Coming up next on this special 2-hour edition of Newsmakers, a UW-La Crosse debate featuring the candidates in the 32nd State Senate District, Jennifer Schilling and Bill Feehan. You're listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum.